Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
Voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine abyss, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
And hello, good morning, and what the hell, and all that other stuff in the world of life and things and other stuffs and stuffs. Welcome back to After Rot. Today we have a special guest on again, returning to talk about his new book, Hellbound, Andrew P. Weston. How's it going, Andrew?
Not too bad. Thank you for having me back. I obviously didn't bore you enough last time.
I don't get bored because I multitask. I have about three computer screens open at any given time, and I've got stuff going on all the time. I've even once done a whole interview while watching a movie at the same time.
Excellent.
I have what's called a weird brain where I can actually multiprocess a lot.
Ah.
People don't understand it. I don't really care. It's not my problem.
It's called being a man.
It's called... Yeah, that. We'll go with that.
My wife's giving me daggers now.
Daggers? Uh-oh. Got to be careful, you know. They know where you sleep.
Yes, I know. That's a trouble.
We won't go into that, though, because as writers, we have creative ways to deal with that.
This is very true.
So, I am aware of the environment that your book takes place in, and I know some of my listeners are also aware of some of that, because I talk about the Heroes in Hell universe a lot, and this book takes place in that universe. And I was thinking, well, we'll talk a little bit about hell in general and then talk a little bit more about your book in specific, and then we'll go into a little bit of other weird stuff and probably talk about a monkey and a song and dance as well, and then talk about, oh, I don't know, Go Go Jet Jaguar. Did you know that they actually released a trailer for a new Gamera movie?
Okay. That's interesting. Go on.
It's just released on Friday.
Ah.
Not related to anything we're talking about today, but I just thought I'd throw something random in.
Okay, thank you.
Check it out later. It's awesome.
Okay.
So, Hell. Heroes in Hell. The universe that started in the 80s with Janet Morris and Chris Morris. How do you feel about Hell?
Ah, well, I absolutely adore it. You know, because although you can't do entirely what you do, because as you know, with a shared universe, it has its laws. You know, they're already established, they're already set, and you know, you're not doing exactly what you would normally do with your own novel. You have to, you know, adhere to the tenets by which that universe is set up, but nevertheless you have a great deal of leeway, and of course with something that's so well established, you've got a lot of history that you can draw on, which I do, and then of course then you've got to weave in your newer characters to that. I mean it's superb. It's a great playground to be let loose in, especially, you know, with all the denizens of the people that you think will end up in hell. There's such a lot you can do. Sure.
Exactly. I mean, I that was the same thing when I was introduced to it. It was like, look at this canvas, look at this landscape. There is so much you can draw on, so many things you can play with. And it's like, ooh, look at all these dead people. It's like, there's like millions of them.
Yeah, very, very true. I mean, when you think about it, all the dead, they wind up in hell. They pick off where they left off when they're alive, except, you know, now it's like no holes barred, you know, and, you know, what can go wrong probably will go wrong, and you can make sure it does, and help it explode, as it were, onto the page. It's a great place to be.
And as Janet likes to say, did you know that there are more than just 10 commandments that you can be breaking to end up in hell? There's over 600 of them.
Oh, yes. Yes, many, many.
And many reasons to be in hell.
I'll do my best to break them all.
Okay. Like, are you keeping a checklist?
I try not to, because my wife does that for me.
Oh, okay. I remember reading something about somebody somewhere, or it was a movie or a story, where the guy actually was keeping a checklist of all the sins he's committed. I was like, okay, I guess being anally retentive is one of them?
Yes. Yeah, we knock on his door in my former occupation.
Yeah, probably. So, now, have you read a lot of the old Hell books from the 80s?
I've started to go through some of them, as I say, because now I'm so busy. I'm at that awkward stage at the moment where I still work and I write in my spare time, and my work involves, I have to work every day. So my time is very precious, so I spend most of it on writing or researching for my writing and doing a few other things. But as and when I can read, I've started going back. You know, I've recently read, I think it was, from some of the newer ones, The Lawyers in Hell, and one or two of the other ones. But what was it? I've just got this in my list. I think one of the first ones to come out. I forgot the name of it now. One of the very, very first books to come out. You know, I've got one or two of those ready on my Kindle to read. So, you know, I'm gradually going back because, again, I treat it as a form of homework, you know, so you can find out what's come from where and why. You know, I really have to do that because as we go on to talk about various things, like, for example, with the Sabiti and Era, the plague god, you know, you've got to know how they operate and, you know, what they do, what they don't do, what their preference are. You know, you've got to know what you're doing if you're referring to these other characters. So the more homework I can do, the better.
Exactly. And it's always fun to read about other cultures' hells and then seeing them represented down in the heroes in hell as well. I mean, you've got Sumerian hells, you've got the Chinese hell, which is more, it's been coming into more of the newer books, less in the older books. More of the older books focused and fixated on the Greek hell, the Roman hell, the classic Christian hell. I think there was one or two of them.
Yes, I mean, that was it. Heroes in Hell, I've put aside, Crusaders as well, Angels, and you know, there are other things like the Little Heliad, which I'll get. The Gate is the fell. It's such a massive scope to it. But of course, I've got to do it little by little, bit by bit. The notebooks I'm compiling as I go through, because you've got to have things set and ready so that if I want to refer to them, I know what I can do, what I can't do, what you can say. You know, you say you have to be very careful. I say that's one of the strictures of delving into a combined universe. But you know, it's fun, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, this shared universe is from the 80s.
Yeah.
A direct, actually one of the first and earliest shared universes used amongst a wide group of authors. We could also go back to Conan and Edgar Rice Burroughs and Lovecraft. Sorry, Lovecraft? No, not Lovecraft. The other one. Yeah, no, Lovecraft. And the third guy whose name I always forget. The three of them used to write in each other's universe as well. But more contemporary stuff, you didn't really see much in the way of shared universes. Now we see much more in the way of shared universes, such as the Star Wars and more of these media tie-in products where it's like, yeah, let's write a book about, we don't know, but we'll write a book about this kind of thing. But like the Heroes in Hell series right after the Thieves World series is one of the first real shared universes that started this whole trend towards creating multiple authors in a singular universe with shared heroes.
Yeah, so it's very well established and very well respected. I'm finding out more and more.
When you talk to people now, do they say, oh, the hell universe, I remember that, any of that?
Yes, certainly. It's funny, I'm now a member of the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers myself, and they had no one actually there from, you know, the Heroes in Hell. And
hold on, there's a society for that?
Oh, well, there's an International Association of Media Tie-In Writers. Yes, they have their own association, and they write for things like, nowadays, as you say, there's that it's prolific for Star Wars, for Star Trek, for, you know, and other things as well, Doctor Who, you know, not just science fiction or fantasy, you know, it's just a whole shed load of things. And of course, when I approach them, and because, you know, to qualify, you have to, you know, belong, to in the right niche, as it were. And, oh, the Heroes in Hell, yes, we remember that, Janet Morrison. So, they were thinking, oh, yes, we've never been approached about that before. And, they research you for a while. I think it took about 8 weeks while they delve into the background of that particular universe. But, they were very enthusiastic, so I was very pleased.
I think we're going to have to get the rest of the crew involved in that, because that's actually pretty cool sounding.
Yeah, yes, it certainly is. Cool, you know, and of course then the people you're mixing with
a wide bunch.
Yeah, you work on that? Oh, that's nice. Have you heard of Heroes in Hell? Yeah, please do.
Exactly, and that's about part of the whole networking thing of any organization or a group of like-minded individuals, right?
Yeah, very true. Very true.
So, you've been reading more and more of the Hell series. Do you have a favorite somebody thing in Hell that's not your own creation?
Well, I've got to tell you, I love the stories in that. From the homework side of it, I love the Sabbati when they were introduced. Not just in Lawyers in Hell, it was. They were also, I think, in Rogues in Hell. I do enjoy the Sabbati and what they're about. I love the stories with. What's her name? Is it Bat? Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson. I really.
You know, okay. Yep.
That slant on it. And of course, then you've got all the genres. So say all the scope of it from you know, from the classic to modern. You know, but the Batman. Yeah, I like the cowboy slant. really, you know, it just sticks in my mind, and I like the way those two characters have been developed. And I always look for those now, especially in. I think the first one I actually read where. What happened to them was in Poets in Hell, which was a superb slant on, you know, how two friends are, you know what Hell's about. It takes what is most precious to you and destroys it or warps it in a way that
it twists it like a knife.
And it was superb, you know, the way it was dealt with in Poets. And so I started looking out for those in subsequent stories. And yeah, I like the way it's developed that particular those two particular characters.
Okay, so your book, Hellbound, is a full-length novel, not a short story, because most of the series is an anthology collection of various writers doing their short stories. And this is the second full-length novel in the new generation of Heroes in Hell. How well do you think it integrates with the whole series?
It should integrate very well, and from the early reports we're getting back of people who, you know, as you know, we've put it out to specific reviewers to see what they think, and we're getting very favourable reports back. So what I did were, when I first realised there was this possibility to write for the universe, I thought, well, if I'm going to introduce a new character, I want to integrate him in a way that, you know, he really, really ties in and becomes established within the universe. So what I did, as you're probably aware, in Doctors in Hell, I introduced the character there in the short story Grimm, and basically, you know, we talk a bit more about him. It's Damon Grimm. That's why it's called Grimm, spookily enough. And he's the Reaper, you know, the Reaper of myth and legend. But to Satan, he's his go-to guy in times of trouble. He's a bounty hunter, if you like, and he leads a group of other denizens of Hell from different periods in history who hunt down renegades. And in Doctors in Hell, in the story Grimm, we're introduced to that character, and I thought that'd be a good way to introduce him, so people get you know, to find out a little bit about him, his style, his methodology, and things like that. And so when we go into Hellbound, he's not just a fresh character, bam, straight off. They're aware of him, what he does a little bit, and the story indeed. So when I discussed it with Janet, the creator of the Heroes in Hell universe, I said to her, wouldn't it be a good idea that if we have, say, he's introduced in Doctors in Hell, he goes on to a novel which discusses his adventures that follow on immediately after Doctors in Hell, and then the next anthology will what takes place in the next anthology where everyone contributes, Grimm's character is actually going to, as it were, continue from the end of Hellbound. And then Hounds, which is the second novel, will follow on from the next anthology. It's going to leapfrog, as it were. So that way he becomes fully integrated, using not just new characters, but old and already long-established characters as well. And it's working very well.
Which I'm very certain Janet probably loved that, because that's how she did the original series.
There's
like three full-length novels through the original first 12 books. They did pretty much something similar. The full-length novel writers were contributing to short stories, and then their short story characters would continue through.
Yes, it's a super way of doing it, because that way then you're adding a lot of history. Remember it's a shared universe, so that if people want to refer to the characters that you have specifically created, they've got this wealth of knowledge. Like, for example, me, with my homework I mentioned, I've got to go through all these other books, which I'm doing little by little, bit by bit. And, you know, for example, I've mentioned the Sabbati. I've, you know, got their little section in the book. But to get to it, I have to go to Lawyers in Hell, Rogues in Hell, you know, other places that they've been mentioned.
So you mentioned the Sabidi. Yeah. Some of my listeners may not be familiar with what they are. They are the seven personified weapons of hell, or heaven's chastisement in hell. Go, what are they about?
Well, the Sabbati. Well, if Error is an ancient Babylonian plague god, is the god of mayhem and destruction, if you like. And his Sabbati are personified weapons, as you say, sons of heaven and earth. They're tools of vengeance and destruction, if you like. And each of them adopts a certain personification in their, they're almost elemental. The first of the seven is who acts, you find most of the time, as a spokesman. He's like a creature who destroys through earthquake and seismic activity. If he generates chasms and things like that, they'll actually chase their victims down. The earth will split open underneath them, swallow them up whole, things like that. The second is a creature of storm. The third, of ice. The fourth is a weapon of pestilence. I think the fifth is blades. It's just like a swirling juggernaut of glittering blades. Absolutely superb. I like him. The sixth, I think, if I remember correctly, is a creature of water and torrents. And the seventh, the most heroically muscled, as he's termed, is a creature of fire. And, of course, together, they're, virtually unstoppable. There's very, very little about them that, other people can stand against. And basically, Error and the Seven have come to Hell to carry out an audit. Because, other powers that be are thinking that perhaps Satan isn't doing his job right. You know, there's not enough punishment going on. Denizens are getting it too easily. So they're there to, shall we say, balance the books. And it's quite good because wherever they go, they live up to the name. They cause mayhem plenty. And they're extremely interesting characters. I do like them.
And well, who doesn't like destruction, mayhem, and complete and total catastrophic type stuff, huh?
Oh yes, I mean, they are in a way remorseless because if you think of like godlike Terminators, they don't show remorse. Nothing escapes their attention, and their weapons, they are designed to do a certain thing, act in a certain way, and although they have personalities, well, they're constrained to the what they were designed to do, and you see various facets of their nature through some of the anthologies and so on, but nevertheless, when it comes down to it, if they're unleashed on someone, they're bound by their nature to act in a certain way. I mean, they're absolutely superb, and being able to refer to them, because they are, if you like, one of the pains in the ass that Damon Grimm has to deal with, and each group, and like Grimm and his hellhounds, which are his fellow bounty hunters, and indeed his inquisitors, the special interrogators, they absolutely hate the Sabbati with a vengeance, and now and again where they brush each other, shall we say, it gets quite entertaining.
Excellent. As I said, mayhem is always awesome.
Yeah, but they're just a few. You've got the other end of the scale, so say the more intellectual, like with a long established characters, and the Undertaker, even in charge of reassignments, if you like, but he just doesn't leave it at that, does he? He's very invasive of what he can do, and stitches people together inside out, upside down, or whatever. And
he likes to be creative.
Yes, in a very perverse way. And of course, Grimm can't stand him. He cannot stand him, because of what about Grimm is a very in your face, and then he'll take your face off kind of creature, whereas he thinks that the Undertaker is oily, disgusting, and of course plagued with bad breath, as everyone knows, one of the fun things that you can keep bringing out and referring to. It's good fun.
And how does Grimm feel about the welcome woman?
He hasn't had a lot of dealings with her. I don't go too deep into it in the actual story, the novels, because I can't refer to too many. I have to keep it to the concept that I originally came up with. So he hasn't met everyone yet, and I've only referred to certain characters. The Welcome Woman, who is it that, oh, the Undertaker goes out with? I've forgotten.
The Undertaker goes out with someone?
Yes. Is it Astarte, I think? Yes. He's,
okay.
He's, yeah, he's you know, he's influenced by her. He's trying to clean up his act, as it were. He dresses, and it's quite comical that is with some of the shocking mistakes that he wears. And of course, Grimm loves that. You know, we refer to that with oh dear, yes, the fashion statements he makes are somewhat perverse as well. It's quite good. I think it's Astarte, Queen of the Dead. Yes.
Yeah, okay, well, The Undertaker is actually one of my favorite characters in the whole Hell series as well, because I just like the whole idea of, like, okay, so everybody is stuck in Hell. They don't have any actual real physical substance anymore. They are just represented bodies being created, destroyed, created, destroyed, created, destroyed. So it's more the soul essence as to what is the story carrying on. It's what do they do? What are their choices? How do they live their lives? And then when they screw something up, they get to meet this mess of a person who puts them all back together and says, okay, you're ready. Go back out there again.
How'd you go? Yes.
Yeah. That's I've always liked him.
No, if he gets creative, then it's kind of like, ooh. Yes.
Exactly.
He's a great character. He's a great character.
Yeah, one of the punished souls that I had in one of my stories had a third arm around his neck, like on his shoulder, and it kept slapping him.
Yes. Nice. That's
because it was like, you're doing something stupid, slap. What? Yeah. Slap. That was just one of those things.
Yeah, it's very, very good, yes.
It's got a lot of opportunity to just mess with. I know. I remember. I can't remember who somebody had. One of the Nazi guys was pushing around a cart with his own organs in it.
Yes. Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff like that in the series.
One of the scenes I've written into Hellbound is because I refer to. What I've tried to do is confine the action to three main cities, although or underworld cities, like it's like an old London town of juxtaposed, where different eras are blended together. As it says, you know, you can cross the street on one side of being a modern day form of London, and then suddenly you're in Victorian times, or suddenly you're in Roman times, and things like that. And one of the things where what you would call Piccadilly Circus is. You've got the place called Cirque du Freak, where those who have really, really annoyed Satan have been sent to the Undertaker for, shall we say, modification. You know, the inside out man, and his organs are literally taped onto him with we call it black masking tape. You call it
duct tape.
Yes, duct tape. It's taped on, and then he's let loose in a razor blade edged. Maze with hellhounds, literal hellhounds on his heels after 30 and of course everyone finds that very entertaining. You've got exploding clowns, you know, they don't have buckets of water, they've got buckets of
exploding clowns.
Yes,
exploding clowns.
Yes, exploding clowns, and you know, all sorts of different things, you know. It's I don't want to say too much, it gives it away.
Okay. But now
the Undertaker is tasked with getting as creative as possible, and some of them are very good. They make you want to urge.
So, you called it the Cirque du Freak. Did you know that in Canada there is the big group called the Cirque du Soleil?
Yes.
Okay. I was wondering if it was in any way related, because the Cirque du Soleil is huge, and they're really put on a good performance.
Yes, yes. I've been influenced by some, shall we say, real life troops and things like that, troupes, and places in London. And what I've done, I've warped the names and blended certain facets together. You know. So,
now, I was going to ask, because you mentioned this bit about the London and everything. The cover of the book, where is that from? Because I love the artwork.
That is a blend, if you like, of the river involved would, in Topside, in the world of the living, is the River Thames, but in Hell it's the River Tombs. Ta-da! Big Ben, the Houses of Parliament, and things like that. And what we've done is we've put it into the Hell setting, because one of the pivotal scenes within the book is when that area, shall we say, the Sabbati give it their attention, shall we say, while Grimm is elsewhere. And as you can see, quite a little bit of destruction is unleashed, which, shall we say, elicits an aggressive response. That's all I'll say. But that cover is taken from a scene in the book where they unleash a great deal of destruction right in the middle of old London town.
And who's the artist? Because that is actually quite a phenomenal piece of artwork there.
Ah, that's our friend. Oh my goodness, I've forgotten him. Roy.
Muratesson? Roy Muratesson?
Hang on a second. Goodness me, that's so annoying. I'm sorry, it's going to come to me in a second.
You said Roy, so I know who Roy is.
I think it's Roy. excuse me, I'm just going to look on the copy of one of my other books. I do apologise, brother, because he makes superb covers. I think it was down to Roy. How do you pronounce his surname?
I think it's Muratesson.
That's him then, because I didn't. That's the first time I've heard his surname pronounced, and I didn't know how you'd pronounce it. Yes,
I could be completely out of whack on that, but I think that's it. I've actually had him on the show as well.
Ah, well, he's a fine fellow because he's come up with some superb concepts, and that's excellent. Yeah, it's a good idea, lovely concept. We banded back and forth, what we can do, again, because there's a series in mind. So with this one, because the majority of the action takes place in old London town, we've used that on the cover. You know, and there's more to come. He's very creative, comes up with some great ideas. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good, because that's the whole point about art, right? It's about expressing. Yes, I had Roy on about 4 weeks, two or three months ago.
Yeah, super cover. And of course, remember, we're talking about a shared universe. So, I have a thing about covers, and I like them to make a statement. Because as I've always said, we're, nowadays there's a lot of books out there.
A lot of books? Just a lot?
Yeah. Where even when you refer to just the quality, well-known writers. When you put all the books together, they'll make like this huge edifice in front of you, this huge wall, and unless an individual brick stands out...
Yeah, that image actually really does sell the story. And I agree with you. A lot of the books that I see out there is like, well, that's kind of bland, that's kind of crappy, that's kind of bland. I'm not going to pick that up unless I know the author. What I used to do when I was younger and used to read crap tons of books, I just walked through the bookstore and it's like, yeah, I like to look at that cover. I like to look at that. I don't know who this is. Let's look it open. Oh, that cover really pops. Let's look inside. Hey, I might read this. And then I would take that home. But if the covers were bland, it's like, I'll think about it if I don't got nothing better to do.
I like it as well. Because sadly, I don't have one in my actual hands yet. The images I have are still on my computer. But when you enlarge it and you look into it, there are certain facets that draw you in, and I like that. I mean, Roy did it with the Ninth. The more you look at the images, it pulls you. Oh, you see that, and it is captured that superbly for Hellbound. I mean, that star in the background, the overcast sky. What's going on in the background? Why is it happening? It tells a story in itself, and I really like that. And I think. What it does, it distinguishes it. Yes, it's a novel within that world, universe, but it also fits in very nicely with... I mean, when you think about the last anthology we did, The Doctors in Hell, that had a bridge scene with lava in front of it and so on. And I thought, it's a nice tie-in, a clever tie-in, in a way that keeps the overall family theme. Because it is a family, the shared universe, it's a family of writers. It keeps that theme going and helps tie everything together.
Absolutely. We'll be right back. I think now might be a good time. What do you think? You want to read a little bit from the story?
If you don't mind.
Go for it. Go for it.
It's totally out of the blue. Hang on, I'll just have to bring something up. What I will stick to, so I know it doesn't upset Janet, in Doctors in Hell, the anthology ended with an excerpt of an entire chapter. Well, I'm not going to read the entire chapter, but I'll read a little bit of it then. That's how I think. There is it. And this is the chapter called A Moment of Clarity. And in it, what's been happening is after Doctors in Hell, Grimm returns to the underworld to find out things haven't gone exactly as planned. I won't say what, so it doesn't spoil what happens in the story. But nevertheless, they will say two or three thorns in the flesh who are leading him a merry dance, and and they keep leaving him clues. They're baiting him, and what they're trying to do is lead him into situations before he's prepared. And one of these clues is leading to where we're going to now. So hopefully, you'll fit into this and see. You know, Grimm is back in the juxtaposed level of hell, which is where Old London Town is, and he has to visit a place that is very well known in London. It's called the Greyfriars, which used to be an ancient monastery, but it's been obviously adapted for hell, and you'll see. Are you ready? And just stop me when before I go too far, because I say this is a chapter length thing, and I'll just read the introduction where he goes and he's transposed into the setting that you'll see. You ready?
Go ahead.
Okay, so in the juxtaposed level of hell, I found Old London Town a conundrum at the best of times, a heady mix of the implausibly warped and secularly grotesque. Its denizens were perfect accompaniment to their city, a stir-fried hotchpot of condemned souls who took the geophysical and temporal irregularities of their hometown in their stride. Every day afterlife here was as much as an enigma as a challenge. You think that having lived here for centuries, I'd be used to it by now. Yet I was still caught by surprise from time to time, boundaries between areas being as fluid as it were temperamental. In this place, more than any other, I discovered that even if you knew a surprise was coming, forewarned was definitely not forearmed, as was the case regarding my current predicament. Nimrod and I were en route to the Greyfriars. Now, in the land of the living, the Greyfriars had been a site of a Franciscan friary that existed from 1225 to 1538 in the northwestern part of the city of London called St. Nicholas on the Shambles. That great establishment had included one of the largest conventional churches in the capital. It had also been home to a studium, an extensive library of logical and theological texts so important it was rivaled only by Oxford University, thus achieving a level of cultural prestige that drew people from all over the then known world, until Thomas Cromwell, a man who became a very good friend of mine here in hell, ordered the transcript seized during the English Reformation. Under his enlightened guidance, the Greyfriars estates were confiscated, the order itself disbanded, and most of its monks banished or executed. Of course, we, here in hell, couldn't let such a monument go to waste. And with a Gothic twist, the friary became the perfect establishment for the truly irreverent. The Greyfriars were now Satan's very own thought police, an unholy order of hermits who regularly vetted the ranks of the devil's children to weed out those with doubts or illusions of grandeur. Every Sunday morning, the pews of the High Church of Lucifer within the friar's domain would be packed with blue suits and spooks, all of whom would undergo their regular confessional evaluation. But the order also served another purpose. The site had retained its archives and was now one of the largest publicly known repositories of occult knowledge and arcane mascots in the underworld, matched only by the Alexandria Library. The Greyfriars defended that vault and its treasures in their care within the Cloisters of Scourging, a great castle-like tower situated in a separate annex. Constructed on a mound built from the bones of those who died during the Great Fire of London some 100 years after the original monastery's passing, the cloister's protection included a series of enchanted wards and powerful temple barriers. The place was also guarded by the friars themselves, who were known to possess skills far more lethal than Shaolin monks tripping on amphetamines. A heavy set of precautions, and yet all these measures were but a secondary line of defence. To reach them, you first had to face the Knight's Bridge. However, bridge what this bridge wasn't a literal construction of wood or stone linking one side to another, but an esoteric conduit from here to there, or from now to then, a multi-dimensional link that spanned hydrospace to get you where you needed to go. Appearing much like a ground-level mushroom cloud from a nuclear explosion, the Knightsbridge encompassed the cloister scourging in a haar of literally thawed steel and smog. The broom was so thick, so cloying, that unworthy individuals had been known to enter only to wander forevermore, lost and alone. And if the thought of facing that barrier wasn't daunting enough, the entire pall was also protected by the Knights Templar, an ancient heraldic order of warriors fanatically devoted to the glory of the Arch-Deceiver and Father of Lies himself, Satan. To get where I needed to go, that obstacle had to be faced. I stood outside the old bully, that's the main court of the Ministry of Injustice here in Juxtapose, and eyed the deceptively calm mists quietly tumbling and twisting over and over on the other side of the street. Okay, number three, what do we do now? Well, we don't do anything. I cut my head at the murky film on the other side of the street. I, on the other hand, need to go into that. Are you sure that's wise? Well, there's no point in us both having our minds screwed with. You've heard the horror stories. Anyone attempting to traverse the breach must pass a series of tests. What they are exactly differs from aspirant to aspirant, but whatever you do contend with, it measures your physical, mental, and spiritual fortitude in a way that flays your damn soul bare. Not a pleasant experience for a denizen of hell. Then why risk it? People like us are especially wicked and depraved. The stronger we are, the more profound the experience will be. Why don't you simply try and phase through or generate a short-range portal? For fuck's sake, if anyone's strong enough, it's you. Because that would be suicide, my friend. Don't forget, that stuff is built in safeguards to prevent any kind of scuttlebutt. And if it were that easy, you get idiots like Tesla storming the place like hyenas on a fat, juicy carcass. You want me to carry on, or...?
No, that's good. That's actually a good example and cross-section of what's going on.
Yeah, it's a scene and then the actions take place. I don't want to give any of the action away, you see.
Well, yes, exactly. I was waiting. Where's going to be a good cut-off point? That sounds good right there.
Okay. Sorry, I hope it wasn't boring, but I don't like to, say, give away some of the action until people get to read it.
It sounds very interesting, well-tinged with historical referendum back to, hey, look, context now. Yeah. But I did have a question as you were reading it. Is it all written in first person?
No. What I've done with this, I did it in a very special way. I've mixed points of view.
Okay.
You have to be very careful when you do that. I first did it in a series of stories I did before I came to Percy Press, after doing a lot of research, and I found that when you do a main character in first person, it involves the reader much more closely. For example, with what Grimm is going through, it pulls you in, like later on when he goes into this thing and he starts to experience some of the defensive measures against himself. It helps you feel the way he feels because it's happening to you. I felt this, I sensed that, oh, that pain, this, you know. And what happens is Grimm himself is written in the first person. However, because Hal is such a complex place, and what this story is a very complex, multi-layered, has a very multi-layered background, other main characters are written in the third person. So what you have to do is be very careful. And for example, this is an entire chapter, and because it's written from Grimm's perspective, it's written in first person, and indeed other entire scenes are written in first person where it involves Grimm. However, in separate places, it's written in third person. I've mixed the part. You have to be very careful, but it works. And I say the feedback we've had, you have to be very careful, you have to be very brave to do it, to mix path. But yeah, it's worked, and so the feedback we've had, the readers really enjoy having that personal involvement with the main character himself whilst finding out what's happening elsewhere.
Cool. Now I was going to ask you about this. The book comes out on October 31st of this year, if I read that correctly.
Yeah.
Halloween, obviously a great choice to release any fun book. How long have you been working on it to get to this point where it's now a baby out in play?
I think it took me about 6 months to do. Obviously the idea, the concept several months in the making. I was doing another work then, but other research in the background. So we're talking about 3 or 4 months of perhaps research and laying the foundations. Because, as I say, when I go into stories, I do a lot of world building, because you've got to give what you're writing really, really strong foundations. Like in this scene here, it just doesn't go someplace, face that, gets over this hurdle, does this. You know, you want to know, well, what is this place? And it has a basis in fact. You know, these monks are based on actual real life monks who used to exist in a real friary in London. So when you know, establish it and give it this element of fact, you know, again, it gives us a strength, a depth that, you know, it's reflected in the story. It really brings it out in different areas. It makes the overall story stronger. So it takes a long time to research, and then of course bringing it all together, as I say, about 6 months it took to write. 6 months.
Do you like have little maps and little diagrams and say, oh, yeah, this goes to that, and then they crawl through this to get through that hole over there? Yes. And then
do it. I always do it as I go through. For example, I have in the background on Google, I have, for example, maps of London, a certain map of London, which I then alter to put in, say, because obviously you have to be careful when you're referring to factual places. So that's why there's a change in names and things like that. So you can sell it's the hell equivalent of it. I had it of Paris, for London, for Cairo, for New Hell, you know, areas of like New York and that. I've got these maps with tags on, sketches. Even when it comes down near the end of the book, there's a fight scene that takes place within a cave. But of course, when you have, and there are multiple characters in it, and of course it's very easy to get turned around and upside down, because you do, you get those odd readers, don't you, who will split everything down to the nth degree. And so, right, there it is, that's where it comes in, that's a north, south, east, west. Right, that is there, that door is there. And so as it goes through, I'm jotting where the characters are. You have to sometimes, you know, you have to go into it that much.
Have you ever played Dungeons & Dragons or any equivalent thereof?
A long time ago.
Okay, because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, well, yes, and then putting it down in the page.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're going to have a battle scene. It takes 5 seconds, but it's going to take us 5 hours to resolve on the gameplay. Okay.
You have to be careful. Yeah, especially when the action then starts and that person's moving there and they roll that side. You know, it's kind of, oh, you know. So it's just, you know, to make sure that everyone is clearly in place and so that really your reader doesn't lose. Because if you lose your reader in such a scene, you know, then it's kind of like, you know, it just breaks it. You want it to flow. So what I do it mainly to ensure that things flow and they have their place, and you know, it just helps the story to shoot along.
Absolutely, and part of that as well. Do you, because of the way you've explained how you did it in first person and the third person point of view throughout the chapters and stuff, do you have like the whole thing storyboarded out for the whole story, where you like plan out, well, this chapter is going to be about this, that chapter is going to be about this, this chapter is going to be about this, yeah, and then work them all through?
Yeah, yes. It's funny, I'm looking at the flowchart I've got now for the sequel, and when it starts off, it's very, very, very simple. This is where I'm going to start, this is where I'm going to end. These are the elements I want incorporated into it. So then I break that down into a more structured format. But then of course you have to do it with the characters. Now, what's this character going to do during the story? They start here, this is where you want them to end up, and they have to experience that and suffer that or have that type of growth there or that taken away from them there. And so, okay, now where would I put that in? And so I have like character flow charts, situation flow chart. It's quite in depth, and then it comes down into my, I call it the floater or the bubbles, and I'm just looking at right now because I'm just coming into the end chapters of the sequel, and you have to do that to make sure, for example, that you know everything, as you say, has its place, it's structured, it makes sense as people are reading it, and of course that you don't miss vital points out. You know, because sometimes you think, oh no, I forgot to mention that in chapter 2, and there you are, chapter 20, and you totally forgot to mention something, you know, important. Clown.
Well, that's why we have the editing process, right?
Oh, yes. But I like to help my editors as much as I can.
Well, yeah, I mean, you want to turn in as perfect a thing as possible and then move on to, oh, well, hey, it's done. No, it's not. We got to do this, this, and this. And, oh.
Yes, it's funny. That's the thing about this as well. You're talking the risk of the alternate points of view. Had no problems with the editing process with it. You know, so it took a lot of structure because, again, of this alternate part, first person for Damon and third person for all the other characters. You know, you have to structure it very carefully, and of course, to do that, you must know what happens when and where within the storyline itself. So it's, yeah, I say it's risky, but when it works, poor. You know, I'm very, very pleased with what we've got. Very pleased. And so is Janet, thankfully, and Chris. They're pleased with it.
Well, that's good, because otherwise, if they weren't pleased with it, why would they bother putting it out?
This is true.
Yeah. So do you have plans on doing any other than shows like mine right now? Do you have any plans of doing any other support type for the book, blog tours, that sort of thing?
I've got various blog tours arranged. I don't know exactly who it's through yet because I'm waiting for the things to come back. Obviously, because of the nature of the story and the setting of it, it's very gothic. I have some nice posts, adverts, blogs, and interviews coming out through some of the best gothic outlets as well. Gothic World is one of them. What's some of the other ones? Dark Gothic. It's just an award-winning magazine, which you know I'm very pleased to have got that. Gothic Life, Gothic E-zine, Dark Resurrected magazine, and they seem to take into the character of Damon Grimm very well. And of course, through you know other outlets which established with it, within the world of fantasy, we've got Blackgate hopefully coming up, Fanboy Comics, Amazing Stories, things like that. So yes, we've got quite a few. Clark's World, yes, it's well supported. Took a lot of planning again, but I believe you know if you put the planning in, then it helps get that initial boost that every story needs. And of course, it brings people who into the shared universe that perhaps might not have heard of it before. So you know, the more we can get reading the Heroes in Hell sagas, the better.
The better for all of us Heroes in Hell writers.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, I know a little bit about your real life work and thing, so obviously there's a lot of time consumed doing that. Do you have much in the way of plans or intentions of doing conventions and stuff?
I will do. I'm hoping from next year onwards, if I have the opportunity, because here in Greece, there's absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. But I would, you know, dearly, dearly love a chance to come across, you know, even to the UK. I know America's a place to be, or Canada. I don't know how many you have there in Canada.
Well, we have quite a few in Canada as well, so.
But some of the major ones, I'd dearly love to get along to. I'd like to do at least one or two next year, if I get the chance.
I know the one big one in the UK is Wolf 359.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very famous. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's one that I would have one day like to just visit, to just, oh, tool around sort of thing, but I never get to go off the continent much, so it's the same.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, fortunately, yeah, I've got plans for it, and, you know, we shall see. You never know what will happen.
Well, that's good. How about a little bit of, how do people get to follow you? Where can they find you and your other stuff that you're involved in, sort of thing?
Well, fortunately, you can do everything my website, which, believe it or not, is andrewpweston.com, will lead you into everything you need to know. I'm on Twitter. I have my own blog, which is the other way around, Weston Andrew, but again, it leads you to it from there. But if you go to Andrew P. Weston or AP Weston, Andrew Weston, they're all linked in. It should take you to my website, and from there, you get my blog, my Twitter, Facebook, and of course it links you into Percy Press itself, who I'm very, very pleased to be with, and so you can see what other delightful works they have on offer there.
Excellent. And obviously you've mentioned you have plans for continuing this storyline through to a trilogy?
Yes, at least. What I'll do, I'm doing an initial trilogy, as I say, leapfrogging it with the anthologies, And then I might let it rest a two, so I can for a year or two to concentrate on other things that I'm developing. Unless, of course, Janet said, "Oh, you know, keep it going." In which case, in the background, I am also developing other ways in which the character himself or other main characters can, be expanded, shall we say?
Cool, cool. And have you given any thought to working with anybody in stories, like any of the other Hell writers, like doing a shared story or whatever together?
I would be interested, but again, it's the time factor involved, because I live here in Greece, for example. You know, for me here now, it's coming up to 5:30 p.m. For you, it's in the morning, isn't it? Just coming up to 9:30? I'll take it.
10:30.
You know, 10:30. That's the problem. Now, if I lived on the same continent or within the same time zone as someone, yes, but the time factor alone, I think, would make it too difficult at the moment. Once I reach the dream of becoming a full-time writer, then I don't mind, because then I can schedule my day, and I've got no problem being up in the early hours, chatting away with someone, discussing ideas, drinking vodka.
Hey, yeah. Wee bit.
Yes. Staring at the moon and singing. Good grief. Wife does at night, no.
Yes, I wasn't going to go there, because it's like, well, that sounds like the stuff you just don't want to know about.
This is true. It's a YouTube sensation, I tell you. No.
Well, yes, YouTube. I do that.
Yeah, but you know, I was thinking of doing that, actually. Getting one or two, once the book is out, I might do one or two other action scenes. You know, because sometimes, although other people who read your work, what you have in your head is sometimes very different, isn't it, to perhaps how a reader perceives it. So I was thinking of perhaps reading several pivotal scenes from the book and just posting it onto YouTube.
Well,
I think it might be a nice idea.
Outside of this discussion, I might have a couple of suggestions for you, and I will share those with you later and offline.
Thank you.
But we are getting close to wrapping up this particular episode of After Raw. I just wanted to say, Andrew, thanks again for coming on and talking about Hellbound and the Heroes in Hell series and Persid Press. It's been great having you on again.
It's been great being here, and thank you very much.
And I know you're getting ready to go and have dinner soon, so we won't let you get your food too cold.
That's okay.
Because, you know, things can be warmed up, right? It's in hell.
Oh, this is true, yes. The coals are stirring.
Yes, coals and embers and all that other fun stuff. So everybody in After Rot Land, welcome back. Come back again every Wednesday night, regularly, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on this same, I can't say Bat Channel because that's a copyrighted thing, but on this same internet channel, tmvcafe.com. Follow us on the Facebook, on the Twitter, on the other various things. Follow Andrew on the various Facebooks, Twitters, and blogs and things. And everybody, have yourself an amazingly after-rotten good time.
Thank you.
Have a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.